This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to WRKF, and today on the show, we are joined by Ed Shahada, the professor and chair of the LSU Department of Sociology. He has a report on how Baton Rouge did in the last year as far as a decrease in its murder rate. Near the highest in America in 2012, there was significant improvement last year, and we'll talk with Dr. Shahada about whether this can continue in 2014. Also on the show today, we'll talk with Ara Rubion about the 8th Annual Jewish Film Festival in Baton Rouge, and we'll visit with Buckets Blades of the Harlem Globetrotters. He's in town to talk about bullying. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It is 877-217-5757. And you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our guest is the Department of Sociology Chair, Ed Shahada from LSU. Professor Shahada has been at the Old War School now for nearly 20 years, 19 to be exact. And during that time, Baton Rouge has been one of the most violent cities in America. 2012, the murder rate went up to 83 for the parish, and last year went down to 64 or 65, depending on who's counting. So it was a significant drop. And this year, unfortunately, we're off to a start in which there have been some homicides, and the latest occurred on St. Joseph Street. It's front page news in the Baton Rouge Advocate today. Homicide detectives are investigating a fatal shooting of a 16-year-old boy found inside his old South Baton Rouge home. Patrick Williams had been living at 1108 St. Joseph, and he was found dead. And so this is an inauspicious start to 2014. But Dr. Shahada, I'm sure you're hopeful that this year will show continuing improvement despite the tragedy of the loss of a 16-year-old young man, Patrick Williams.
Yeah, it is tragic, especially when a child is killed. I'm hoping for good things for 2014, although I got to tell you, one of the things that keeps me awake at night is we've had so much success in 2013 that we're going to be battling our own success in 2014, but we've just got to keep going.
I gave the parish figures, 83 murders in 2012, and Hiller Moore, the district attorney, says probably 65 for 13, which is about 22% decrease. How does the city itself look?
Even better. We went from 67 in 2012 to 49 in 2013. That's a drop of almost 27%. That's just unheard of.
It is something that will be watched closely in 2014. Was it a fluke, or was it because of actions that were taken?
Oh, no. It was actions that are taken. It was brave. It was street ops, police working hard, smart policing with data. It's a lot of good things, but we've got to keep it going. I would say one thing though about 2013. Going from 2012 to 2013, it was a 27%, almost a 26-27% drop. But remember that in 2012, starting in September, that's when we began to see the drop, because that's really when Brave began. So if you were to look at the entire period over that drop, we're probably looking at 35% drop. It's huge, just a huge drop.
Mm-hmm. We often focus upon the murder rate, and for good reason. As noted, Baton Rouge was among the most violent cities in America on a per capita basis, right at the top, close to it, in 2012. What about other crimes?
The police have not released those yet. It's part of what's called the Uniform Crime Reporting System, so they haven't released that yet. But I can tell you this, that there's been a significant drop in other violent crimes, including robbery, aggravated assault. Those have dropped. Mm-hmm. And then, and shootings. I think our preliminary data suggests that shootings are down by almost 50% for the year.
Shots fired.
Shots fired.
which can now be monitored.
Yes.
Because of the amazing technology that is out there.
Right.
But there are pockets of activity going on that I know are particularly disturbing to people who are not accustomed to having crime issues in their communities. Reports, for example, around the LSU Lakes, an unlikely place, but apparently there have been some issues there. And recently in Tara, there have been some home break-ins that have been reported. These kinds of things happen, unfortunately, at different times, but it's a situation in which the crime is, despite what is sometimes reported, it's not isolated to one particular area. It's not the 70805 area code and nothing else.
That's exactly right. You know, we got the BRAVE grant, which is a $4 million grant, federal grant, to reduce crime in 70805 and 70802. But what that's really translated into, Jim, is a parish-wide effort to reduce crime. So here's what happens. Every month, we create something called Dashboard. Dashboard is a complex document that shows crime in every single sector and district, sub-district, in the city and in the parish. And we lay it out for law enforcement. And on Dashboard is, all right, we tell them, in this sub-district, this is where the crime's occurring this month. This is where you need to go. These are the people you need to watch for. Mm-hmm. These are the gangs that are active here. And so we kind of following the New York model, where then the commanders can browbeat their sub-district commanders and say, what's going on in your district? So we're doing it area by area by area. We're not limiting it to 70805 and 70802.
297-5633, if you'd like to join the conversation with Edward Shahada, professor and chair of the LSU Sociology Department, recognized nationally for his work on the crime front. How did you become immersed in this particular pursuit?
You know, I started life as a mathematical demographer. Well, I actually started with a physics degree and then became a mathematical demographer and through grad school. And if I had to sit through one more seminar on breastfeeding intervals in Africa, I was going to stab somebody in the eye. Mm. And so I had a great advisor, met somebody at Penn State. He was a great criminologist, and the rest is history.
Has his degree from Penn State University. I assume Joe Paterno was the head football coach when you were there. HB in Denham Springs. HB, good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Shahada.
Good morning, gentlemen. Doctor, please don't interpret this as an off-the-wall question, but if memory serves me correctly, Chief Dwayne White was a principal instigator of the BRAVE program, and if that being true, why did we have such a problem with his dismissal? Thank you, sir.
I don't know the politics or the administrative decisions. It's not that I don't want to comment on it. And by the way, that's not an off the wall question. It's a very fair question. BRAVE actually comes from Professor Kennedy, who created a program called Ceasefire, which is a multifaceted group violence reduction strategy. And so you're seeing these initiatives around the country, and the person that actually is really responsible for pushing this thing through, if I were to give credit to anybody in the parish, it would have to be the district attorney, who's really, really force-fed this thing through the system.
297-5633 is your number. District Attorney Hiller Moore, the BRAVE effort has, about $4 million in funding? Is that correct?
That's correct, across three different grants.
So that's a significant infusion of cash, and it's money well spent if the murder rate is attributable to the decline in murders is attributable to the funding and the actions. What exactly has BRAVE done to address the situation we have?
Well, several things. By the way, most of that money goes to the communities to help them deal with crime. So what BRAVE does is several things. One of the things is, as I pointed out, is Dashboard. That's intelligent, what we call smart policing, where at LSU we have a team of people that sifts through tens of thousands of records every few weeks so that we can guide law enforcement to specific people and to specific areas. We've dropped crime 25%, 26% in the city. We haven't hired a single extra police officer. It's just smarter policing, and this takes time. This takes money. The second thing is what we call the community buy-in, where we're spending they're spending resources on trying to create connections with the community, telling people in the community, if you see something, say something. And that takes time and effort as well. In addition, there's the thing called the call-in, which is a very dramatic event. It happens probably around twice a year. Mm-hmm. And what happens is we identify people who are players in group violence, what we call, gangs, group violence, and they're brought in collectively, all at once, into a big room. And in that room is the district attorney and the U.S. attorney and the police chief and so on and so forth, and the sheriff. And they're given three choices, Jim. Choice number one is take our help. If you want the help, if you want a GED, you want a job, you want a place to stay, you need drug counseling, family counseling, we'll help. Choice number two is don't take our help, but just go back to your communities and stop hurting people and send the word out. Or choice number three is don't take our help, go back and keep doing what you're doing. And one group, I think back in March, tried that, and that gang is not around anymore.
297-5633, Charles on North Foster. Good morning. You're on WRKF with Ed Shahada.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Ed. I live here in the 70805. This is my home. I'm a former Marine. I'm a three-time college graduate. In my entire time here in Baton Rouge, I've noticed the disparity between the community being police and the police. The police department is overwhelmingly white. The city of Baton Rouge is progressively non-white. In addition, that anytime there's a grant to address the community's needs, Southern University, the sociologists there who have an intimate knowledge of the community, are noticeably absent. And as an African American, it's still unacceptable the high murder rate that's in this community. But I hear no one addressing it. You've talked about smart policing and the community buy-in. I'd like to hear your comments about how we can grow that while at the same time making this effort more inclusive. Thank you.
First of all, thank you for your service. You mentioned you were a former Marine. You mentioned this is not just a citywide or parish-wide problem. This is a nationwide problem of including African Americans, and I would also mention, by the way, that with the growing Latino community, to have greater representation in city council, on police departments, and so on. I'm as a sociologist, 100% in agreement with you. I've dedicated my entire life to studying the race differences in crime, and now I study the ethnic differences in crime, Latino communities and so on, and immigration. And that is something. Now, I can say that on Brave, we have good African-American representation. As far as the police department as a whole is concerned, you'd have to ask the police chief about that.
The number of murders, whether it's 83 or 65, the overwhelming majority of the victims are black, right?
94% 94% are black.
94% are black.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, Charles, I'm sure, has a point that the white community is probably not, I don't think there's any probably about it, not as engaged as it would be, let's say, if 94% of the victims were white.
I've heard this. People have come up to me and said, well, look, it's not happening in my neighborhood. What do I care? And my answer to that is, number one, how do you know that at the next parade or the next public event or at the mall, your child will not be hit? Crime tends to spread. Number two, from a purely humanitarian standpoint, there are people being killed in these communities. It doesn't matter if they're black or white. They deserve attention.
297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757 outside the city, and Inkster Show at WRKF.org online for Dr. Edward Shahada. 19 years at LSU, now head of the Department of Sociology, and on the front lines of crime in our community. Back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. LSU Sociology Chairman Edward Shahada is with us for a while longer. 297-5633. We're talking crime in Baton Rouge, the latest murder victim in our community, 16 years old, Patrick Williams, was killed at the intersection of Myrtle and St. Joseph. And investigators are trying to determine why this young man was found dead in his home at 1108 St. Joseph Street. Last year, the good news is that Baton Rouge as a city dropped from 67 to 49 murders. And as a parish, we dropped from 83 to 65. So that's the good news. And Dr. Shahada has been out there trying to make our community a safer, better place. 297-5633, Joshua in Mid-City. Hi, Joshua. You're on the air with Ed Shahada.
Hi, Mr. Jim and Mr. Ed. My question is, what role do you think drug decriminalization or legalization has in the reduction of violent crime in general and in freeing up police resources to address violent crime specifically?
Drugs?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. By criminalizing possession of marijuana and other things, what we actually do is create a black market, which then can be filled with gangs. Significant number of gangs do make money through the black market and illegal sale of drugs. Our police spend an enormous amount of time dealing with vice crime, dealing with drugs and so on. And quite frankly, not only on the streets, but in the prisons. The prison sentences, the sentence lengths for drug violations are, well, on the verge of barbaric. I'm not fully quite personally ready to say that we ought to legalize marijuana, but the amount of effort that we spend and the punishments and the sentences for drug use or drug possessions is, in my view, just off the wall.
Hiller Moore was on this show, as was the coroner, Bo Clark, and they both commented on the rise in the deaths by cocaine, not heroin, not cocaine,
heroin, yeah.
Heroin in this community in the past year. How are those deaths categorized? They're not homicides, but nonetheless, there's a rapid spike in that realm as well.
And that is exceedingly dangerous. Heroin is a true evil. And I know of someone personally who died through a heroin overdose back in August. A very, very sad case. We have to spend all resources and take all efforts possible to stop the spread of heroin. It is so exceedingly dangerous.
297-5633. Misdemeanor jails. You think that's a good idea?
Yes.
Why?
All the research shows, I know we opened up our misdemeanor jails. In 2012, we opened up our misdemeanor jail for 2 weeks in July. In 2011, we opened it up for approximate period of time in August. We're doing research now to find out what kind of a crime reduction that resulted in. Preliminary evidence suggests that it was a significant reduction. I don't have the numbers with me at the moment. There's research all over the country that suggests that if you open up your misdemeanor jails 24/7, that you can get a significant reduction in crime. What is a misdemeanor jail? It serves two functions. Let's say someone gets picked up for simple theft. Normally what happens is they get a citation. So the police officer will write them a ticket, citation to appear in court at a certain time. Sometimes those people don't appear in court. There's no certainty of punishment. But if you have the misdemeanor jail open, what happens is they get booked. Now, they're only going to stay there for a few hours, but they're going to get fingerprinted. They're going to get their record in the system, and it's going to be a shock to them, even though they're only going to be there for a few hours. And the evidence suggests that it does reduce crime. The other function of a misdemeanor jail is that police will be able to run warrants 24/7. Do you know how many people in the city, through city court, have warrants? You know how many outstanding warrants there are right now? 102,500 outstanding warrants. We need to run those warrants and make people responsible for them.
So what happens when people don't show up for their appearances in city court?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And I don't blame them for that, because they're overwhelmed. But if we had a misdemeanor jail and we had an active, funded constable's office or whoever that can actually run these warrants 24/7, we'll know right away if these people have warrants and they need to be picked up for it. But the jail closes at 5 o'clock in the evening. When do you think crime spikes in Baton Rouge? Starting at 5 o'clock, goes all the way until the early morning hours, and then it goes back down when the misdemeanor jail opens up again.
297-5633 for Ed Shahada, chairman of the sociology department at Louisiana State University. Sue and 70810. Sue, good morning. You're on the air.
Yes. I wanted to ask a question about there was a Father Greg Boyle who came from Los Angeles to speak in Baton Rouge. And about a ministry that they have going there called Homeboy Ministry, and or Homeboy Industries, where they're getting people out of gangs and those people trying to get their life straight after, criminal activity or coming out of jail. And they've been very successful. And at that talk, both Sheriff Sid Gautreau and Attorney General Hillary Moore were present. And I know that Father Boyle spent some time with the officials in Baton Rouge prior to his speaking. And I wondered if you could give some background about what might be considered and in a line of trying to replicate those ministries that are being done.
Could you respond, Dr. Shahada?
Yeah, I'm not actually familiar with his work and what was being done in that case. I do know that here in Baton Rouge, the faith-based organizations are tremendously helpful. Hope Ministries is an integral part of Brave. We just flat out, I'll say it right now, flat out, we just couldn't do it without them. We simply could not do it without them. But it is a concerted effort. It can't just be one thing. Faith-based organizations are extremely important to the equation. But we can't do it without the police. We can't do it without LSU. We can't do it without the Dream Center. We can't do it without the Louisiana Sports Network. The whole mantra here is that what I call, this is not the Rambo model, where it's one person who just kind of went out there and did it all by him or herself. This is the Apollo 13 model, where you got a whole group of people getting together and combining their talents. One of the things that I remember Hiller kept saying at the at that call-in, where you bring in those 30, 40 people that are involved in gangs and you basically have a come to Jesus with them. And he said, look around the room. We've got the sheriff's office, we've got the U.S. attorney, we've got all these ministries. We have LSU. We're all on the same team now. The game is over. The game is over. This is a concerted group effort, and that's what the characteristic. That's the takeaway from this thing is that it is a combined effort from, I think, something like 120 organizations working now with Brave.
Judy on Highway 44. Hi, Judy. You're on with Ed Shahada.
Good morning, gentlemen. I was wondering, well, just a small comment, but I was wondering, with all of the people working together, do you think that sometimes some of the problems do tend to be disproportionately among the working poor? Because I did see an incident where a woman who was working for, her license had expired. She wound up getting just picked up randomly, and her kids wound up in foster care. This was a woman who was trying to do and fell between the cracks.
You know, I once did a study back in the early 2000s, about 10 years ago, and it won an award, and it was a study of crime in Baton Rouge. What predicts crime in Baton Rouge? Is it race? Is it age? Is it what could it be? Well, the study found what I think a lot of us expect, but I was surprised that I found it so cleanly, was that race was not a predictor of crime once you controlled for other factors. Victimization or offending. It was poverty and inequality. There's no question. If you were to, I mean, This is not my opinion. This is what the numbers are saying, that in Baton Rouge, I divided Baton Rouge out into 276 neighborhoods, and they looked at them all at once in a multivariate analysis. What predicts crime in Baton Rouge? And it's, once you control for all factors, it's poverty. It's not race. If you were to bet money to find out where you're going to find crime, don't look for the black areas. Don't look for the areas where you got a lot of youth. You look for the areas that are poor. Absolutely. I completely agree with that. However, I would say this. I was raised to believe that you can't deal with crime until you deal with the underlying social problems, poverty, unemployment, despair, and so on. This was the mantra that I was raised on as a sociologist, and Brave has changed my mind. We can't cure all of society's ills, but we can reduce crime. This is what New York did, and this is what we're doing here, that poverty and crime don't have to go together. I used to believe that you can't solve crime until you solve poverty and the economic problems. But now I believe the reverse, that you have to solve crime first, then you can deal with other problems.
What about Baton Rouge having the highest AIDS rate in America? Any?
You know, if you were to map out AIDS, crime, spousal abuse, despair, all the maps look the same. So these social problems like AIDS, murder, dropout rate, all those things, they all occur in the same places. In other words, what we in sociology call these are collinear in time and space.
Last week at the Press Club of Baton Rouge, when Governor Jindal addressed the group and Gamely took questions of all kinds for an hour, one of the inquiries was about the AIDS rate in Louisiana, which ranks at or near the top in the United States, and Baton Rouge and New Orleans are in the top three, Baton Rouge being number one. And when asked why that was the case, he said he didn't know. And when asked, he said you'd have to ask a public health official, and of course he was once Secretary of the Department of Health, and then when the follow-up was, well, you were a public health official, he said, well, I'm not an epidemiologist. Do you have to be an epidemiologist to understand why Baton Rouge might have the highest AIDS rate in America?
No. No, you don't have to be. You have to understand that it's enough to understand the social process in these communities. As I said, where you get AIDS cases, you're going to get drug use, you're going to get out-of-wedlock births, you're going to get crime. Social problems tend to overlap on top of each other. If you deal with, when we're dealing with crime here, as we're dealing with crime, I wouldn't be surprised if some of the other social problems started to reduce.
The governor doesn't talk about crime, and I must say his predecessors didn't either, and he certainly doesn't talk about AIDS. It doesn't fit the narrative of the Louisiana miracle, but it's difficult to ignore those as much as some public officials might try.
In 2009 and 2010, New Orleans and Baton Rouge were, well, New Orleans was number one, and Baton Rouge was the second most violent city in America, or thereabouts. So that meant that this corridor was the most dangerous in the entire country. No, I didn't hear a lot of public officials talking about it. Crime is very stigmatizing, mm-hmm. and they tend to shy away from bad news, but when the good news comes, they do show up at the party.
When you say most dangerous in the country, we're talking about one of the most violent places in the world.
Absolutely.
In the world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The actual murder rate, I think, for example, I had a chance to visit the occupied territories, Jerusalem, Ramallah, and all those areas. And even there, there wasn't an uprising at the time. Even there, the murder rate was much lower than it is here. Mm. Much, much lower.
Hmm. Well, when you're a sociologist and a mathematician, let's say hypothetically there's 70 murders in Baton Rouge in a given year, on the average, and average lifespan is around 80 years. So that would be 5,600 murders over the course of a life, and how many people are in the city of Baton Rouge?
230,000 about.
Okay, so 5,600, 230,000. Do the math on that. Your percentage over the course of 80 years, your life of being killed, If it's 5,600 divided into 230, what's that percentage? You got your calculator right there.
It's so 5,600
into 230,000. This is over the course of
2.4%.
2.4%.
Right. It's pretty high.
Pretty high.
But now, remember that over that 70 years, that 230,000 is not the same people. There's a lot of turnover. Some of those 230,000 dies. Some of them are replaced. But nonetheless, if we were to do that same calculation for some African American communities, and
it's,
I don't have those.
It's over 10%.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe 20.
Right. So your point is well taken, that homicide and violence is a looms very large in the lives, not just in this city, but in some of these other communities. That's why in 2009 and 2010, I became part of, I got to be, you know, I joined Brave. My son experienced a violent crime. I just said, enough. Time to move on. Let's fix this.
Are you at liberty to say what happened to him?
He was robbed at gunpoint. He was beaten with a shotgun. Mm. And yeah.
Well, and when you, let's if it's 2.4%, and you have five members in your family, then suddenly the odds of having being murdered go up to 12%.
Mm-hmm.
And even though on most nights everybody is okay, over the course of a lifetime, if we live in an area that's particularly violent, over the course of a lifetime, those odds tend to catch up with somebody.
Yes. And the odds of you knowing someone that was murdered, even someone within your fairly close circle, in some areas, there's virtual certainty that that's going to happen. Virtual certainty that someone, that you or someone in your close circle will be victimized by a violent crime. Almost certain.
But you do think, as we depart on hopefully a positive note, that things are getting better.
You know, New York dropped its murder rate 80% in 19 years. If we can get half of that, that would be wonderful. I used to think that you can't deal with crime until you deal with social problems. I've converted. I've seen the light now. You can lower crime. You can lower crime. And we're doing it.
All right. Well, Brave, is it going to keep going?
Absolutely. It's going to keep going. Full swing. In fact, this year we're going to do things even more aggressively than the year before.
How so?
We're going to try to get even a closer tie between LSU and the police. You know, this whole thing we do every month with Dashboard, where we get all these data, that took a long time to ramp up and to create all the connections. And I think the connection's even going to be greater in 2014 than in 2013. I'm anticipating good things.
Well, Dr. Shahada, we look forward to getting a progress report from you. We visited with you mid-year last year, so hopefully we'll do that again in 2014, if not sooner. Thank you.
Pleasure was mine.
And we shall return with Ara Rubion about the Jewish Film Festival coming tomorrow. And Buckets Blades from the Harlem Globetrotters is dribbling into the studio as we speak. 297-5633 is your number. Back after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. And Ara Rubion is in studio to talk about the 8th Annual Jewish Film Festival. Good morning. Good morning, Ara. Some outstanding productions starting tomorrow.
Tomorrow night.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're very excited with the program. Wednesday night, opening night, is a film called The Other Son, which is kind of a twist on the old story of The Prince and the Pauper. Those of you in the audience might be familiar with the story of babies switched at birth. This story starts out with a Palestinian baby and an Israeli baby being switched at birth because of a terrorist attack on the hospital where they were born. Flash forward 18 years, the Israeli son is going to enroll in the IDF. They do a blood test and then discover, hey, wait a minute, this isn't your son. And that all happens in the first 15 minutes. And the rest of the movie kind of explores the whole psychology of identity and who is a Jew and what is it like, you know, to live in both roles in modern Israeli society.
Well, and that's just the beginning. Tuesday, In the Shadow.
Right. Thursday evening, we're doing a film from the Czech Republic called In the Shadow. I read an interview with David Ondráček, who's the director, who said that his greatest influence on the making of this film were a couple of other films. One was Blade Runner, and also the film Seven, which is kind of a detective thriller as well. And that's what this film is. I watched it and was reminded very strongly of Chinatown. Because it's a kind of a period piece, film noir, detective thriller, where the detective is investigating what seems to be a pretty, you know, simple jewelry heist, but he keeps peeling back the layers. We're going to have Dr. Carl Reuter speak night.
Very good.
And I wanted to make sure I mentioned that because I know he's a friend of your show.
Yeah. In the Shadow, Thursday night, 7 o'clock, and afterward, Dr. Carl Reuter, who spent more than 45 years at LSU.
Right, at LSU.
Yeah. And then Saturday.
Saturday night, we're showing a film called Broadway Musicals, A Jewish Legacy. And, you know, if anyone is a fan of Broadway musicals, you have to come and see this because it will have film clips and song segments from pretty much, you know, as they say, you know, the cavalcade of favorite Broadway musicals and kind of a historical documentary investigation of who the principal players are in that in that area.
And then Sunday, two shows starting at 1 o'clock. The matinee is 6,000,001. What is this about?
We try to show a Holocaust film every year because this is a topic that almost universally people want to know about more. This year, it's a little bit different as in the last couple of years in that we're looking at what's called the second generation. Not so much the generation of people who survived or maybe didn't survive the Holocaust, but their kids. And how do they deal with it? And anyone who's grown up in a family with multiple siblings, I did, I had three siblings. Over the years, you realize that each of your siblings has memories of the parents that are vastly different depending on what their birth order is and so forth. In this one, the parents that the siblings are remembering is a Holocaust survivor. And so it's by turns, you know, sad, hilarious, infuriating, and it's just a terrific look at that topic.
That's at 1 o'clock on Sunday, 6,000,001, and that'll be followed by the finale at 3, the remarkable Kirk Douglas, who's still around.
Still around.
Pushing 100 years old.
That's right. Just had his 97th birthday. The film is called Cast a Giant Shadow, and it's based on a true story of Colonel Mickey Marcus, who was an Army veteran from World War II, who volunteered to join the Israeli Defense Forces to help them gear up for the War of Independence. He became their first general. I call the film kind of Ocean's 11 meets Exodus. Because it's got, you know, Kirk Douglas, Angie Dickinson, John Wayne, Frank Sinatra, Yul Brynner, Senta Berger. I mean, it is a vintage, you know, mid-60s Hollywood blockbuster that tells a story that not a lot of people are familiar with.
Cast a Giant Shadow at 3 o'clock with Kirk Douglas. Really one of the fine actors of
We contacted his management to see if he could Skype into the theater. And we were informed, no, Mr. Douglas will not be making that appearance. But I'm gonna give it one more shot to see if maybe he can send us a written statement of some sort. Because he really is one of the last of that generation of great Hollywood actors.
Mm-hmm. Survived a stroke, and a guy who's been around for a very long time is still active in various...
He just wrote something on Huffington Post the other day, Julie told me.
Yeah, he's amazing. I recall him being interviewed back in the 70s by Dick Cavett, and they both took off their shirts as they were being interviewed to show off their impressive
I missed that.
Physique.
Oh, that,
so maybe you and I can do that.
I'm taking it off right now.
And we've got Buckets Blakes coming in a few moments, the Harlem Globetrotters. So he's an impressive guy, and I'm sure he would be impressed with you, Ara. Five trailers of all five films in a 12-minute video available at the Manship Theater site where all these films will be presented.
And right.
They've been with you from the start.
They have. People can get more details also on our website, brjff.com, and also follow us on Facebook.
And Baton Rouge has an extremely active Jewish community, and this is a chance for people of all faiths and all all backgrounds to show
Absolutely.
Up and see this. It's not just a film festival for Jewish people. It's a Jewish film festival for all people.
That's right.
And you became involved when?
This is my third year, actually, as a co-chair, Julie and I.
Julie
Hoffman.
Whose voice is heard?
Around the clock on WRKF. I've heard her voice at literally 24/7. She does all the PSAs now. Her parents, Harvey Hoffman and Paula Hoffman, originated the festival. I had the good sense to marry into the family. And Harvey's untimely death in 2011 kind of gave us a push to continue his work. So this will be our third year doing the festival.
Well, Harvey's quite a man, and I feel
Terrific
his presence
guy.
Right now. He sat in your chair right there
yes,
many times.
I'm sure he did.
And you joined the Baton Rouge community by way of Detroit.
By way of Detroit. Julie and I are an eHarmony couple, which always blows everybody's mind. But I came down here for the very first time in 2003. We got married in 2004. I had never even been to Louisiana, let alone, you know, moving down here. But it's been a terrific experience.
We're glad you're here.
Well, thank you.
And there, I'm told, are 80 other Jewish film festivals around.
That sounds about right. They're in
the
unlikely place. There's one in Hong Kong. And so, you know.
Well, it's very nice that Baton Rouge has one. And some outstanding films will be available for public mm-hmm. viewing. And it closes with Cast a Giant Shadow Sunday at 3, preceded by 6 Million and One. Saturday night, it's Broadway Musicals, A Jewish Legacy. And then tomorrow night, the 15th, it starts with The Other Son at 7 p.m. And then Thursday, In the Shadow at 7, followed by a discussion with
Dr. Carl Reuter.
Mm-hmm. Well, good luck.
Thank you.
And appreciate your information. Always good to see you, Ara Rubin. And we're joined now by Buckets Blakes, who is in the Guinness Book of Records, a Harlem Globetrotter. Why are you in the Guinness Book of Records?
For sinking two underhand shots. Underhand is politically correct. Some people will call them granny shots from half court at the 2010 All-Star basketball game or All-Star weekend in Dallas. Me and Jason Kidd tied.
How many did you sink?
I made two.
And, two from half court?
Yes.
So you got to have some strength.
I have
good eye-hand coordination.
Strong lower back and some accuracy.
Will Chamberlain used to do the granny shots, as did Rick Barry.
Will was a Globetrotter before he played in the NBA.
I know. Yeah. He was indeed. And he always commented on those times with Meadowlark Lemon. He commented that the ladies like the Globetrotters.
Definitely, you know. I mean, we're the first all-men sports team to have a woman play. 1985, Lynette Woodard came to the Harlem Globetrotters, and because of her, there's been 12 in our history, three currently on our team now.
Always on the cutting edge are the Harlem Globetrotters. Remember the Go Man Go? The genesis of the Globetrotters, Abe Saperstein?
Yep. Daughter, Eloise Saperstein, comes to the game every year in Chicago. For those of you out there that don't know, the Globetrotters started in Chicago and not Harlem, New York. And so does his granddaughter and her kids, Aubra Saperstein, and the family come down to the game in Chicago every year. So we get to share a little history with them as well.
Well, Buckets Blakes, it is Blakes, by the way, not Blades, as he is listed in the Guinness Book of Records. Buckets Blakes has been a member of the Globetrotters for how long?
This is my 12th season.
12th season?
Yes, sir.
How many games a year do you play?
Well, we have a red, white, and blue tour, so we play over 400 games a year. Our North American tour consists of 300 games. It starts December 26th and it ends in April, but there's 300 games in 250 cities, 48 states, 6 Canadian provinces, and Puerto Rico.
You play all those games?
No.
I didn't think
so.
No,
we have three units, so red, white, and blue. I don't think I'd make it.
You might play 100 games a year.
Oh, for sure. Definitely 100 or more because we travel abroad as well. I've been to 74 countries since I've been on the team. I'm on my third passport, but we play all over the world, and it's definitely a wonderful experience.
74 countries?
Yes.
In 12 years?
Yes.
Did you ever lose? Did Globetrotters ever lose a game?
I heard they lost in 71, but I wasn't born, so it wasn't my fault. You guys got to talk to Curley and Metalark and those guys.
Who beat them? The Washington Generals. Red Clots? Yeah.
We've lost 345 games in our history, though, and since 1926, because we started off strictly as a competitive basketball team. So I don't know if you know our history, but Abe Saperstein, the Jewish guy, was capable of promoting the Globetrotters. Originally, I forget the name of the guy who kind of had the guys at first. And once Abe Saperstein got a hold of him, he had a name around the Chicago area. And they started playing, they didn't allow blacks to play in white-only leagues. So they started beating teams around the Chicago area, eventually outside of Chicago. And then they came against the all-white Minneapolis Lakers in 1948 for the world championship. They beat them that year. And then they only won by 1 point, so everyone thought it was a fluke. They played them again in 1949. And beat him again, and that led to Nat Sweetwater Clifton being the first African-American to sign an NBA contract in 1950 with the New York Knicks, thus opening the floodgates for all nationalities to play.
Well, other athletes in various sports have been Globetrotters. I think Bob Gibson was a Globetrotter.
Yes, Bob Gibson. I talked to I'm friends with Geese Osby. He told me he turned down an offer from the Cubs, the Chicago Cubs, to play with the Globetrotters. Mm-hmm. Because it was such, a great team at that time. And, I know Connie Hawkins. Connie Hawkins lives, I see him at the barbershop. I'm back home in Phoenix, so still running to him. He still has his
Connie had much enough hair to go to a barbershop. But,
He goes. I think he only gets the sides tightened up real good.
Connie Hawkins, if I remember right, was on the ABA team in 1967 in the first year of the American Basketball Association that beat the New Orleans Buccaneers for the title.
Oh, wow.
He was with the Pittsburgh Condors. And he went on to have a fine NBA career with the Phoenix Suns. Now, Buckets, you'll be at Dufrock Elementary later today. What are you going to talk about to the kids at Dufrock Elementary?
Well, we partnered up with the National Campaign to Stop Violence and put together an ABCs of Bullying Prevention program. The National Campaign to Stop Violence puts on an initiative every year. They get 60,000 kids from 30 different cities across the United States to submit essays or written essays on violence in their lives. And the number one cause of violence cited in those essays were bullying in schools, or bullying in general. And they thought it'd be a great marriage between them and the Harlem Globetrotters because they know we visit 400 schools talking about character every year. We just switched the program to our ABCs of bullying prevention. So the A is for action, and the action we encourage the kids to take if they see someone being bullied is to find the nearest teacher, the nearest adult, or the principal to tell what's going on. We don't want them to jump into a bullying situation themselves. The B is bravery, and what we mean by bravery is to tell the kids to stick up for themselves by telling the bully to leave them alone and simply walking away with a smile on their face, because bullies like to take the power of happiness away from you, and you never want to let anybody steal your joy. And also the C is compassion. And just to get other kids who haven't been bullied to show compassion to those who have been bullied by, maybe going up to that person and telling them everything's going to be okay, making that person your friend for the day by inviting them to maybe eat lunch with you, play with you during recess, or even any after-school activities as well. So that's our main program for this year, but we have several community outreach programs. I mentioned our character program is called CHEER, and CHEER is an acronym. C is cooperation, the H is healthy mind and body, first E, effort, second E, enthusiasm, the R is responsibility.
Buckets Blakes. Now, that's at 4 o'clock, 4:30 today at Dufrock Elementary, which is at 330 South 19th, and Buckets will be in town for a few days. Globetrotters are bringing their 2014 Fans Rule World Tour to the Baton Rouge River Center. 2 o'clock and 7 o'clock.
Two games. Yeah,
you're going to play both games.
Yeah, we always play two games on our doubleheader days. Got to play two.
What happens if you get hurt?
then they got insurance.
What was it? Vince Lombardi said, "If you can walk, you can run." But 2 o'clock and 7 o'clock, and you play the same opponent.
It's called the, yes, we do. They're called the World All-Stars. It used to be the Washington Generals. And I think they're also owned by Red Klotz. Red Klotz, speaking of, you guys were talking about someone who's 97. Red Klotz, I believe, is 91 or 92. And he's the only Washington general ever get his jersey retired. They retired his jersey in Wells Fargo Arena in Philly.
Well, when I was a little kid, I saw Red Klotz play at the Loyola Fieldhouse in New Orleans. He's 91 years old. He had
maybe
to be
92.
He had to be up there, but he was still firing away and still losing to the Globetrotters. Well, thank you, Buckets, and good luck this week in Baton Rouge. Thanks for visiting with us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Take care. We'll be back tomorrow for Jessica Kane. I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.